You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Wednesday, November 16th. My pleasure to be with you. Bottom of the hour, we're going to be talking to my friend Martin Cothran. Martin, who is a classical education author, editor, advocate, and also a policy analyst for the Family Foundation of Kentucky. Does a lot of work on issues affecting the common good and a very popular spokesperson on various public issues. He's got an excellent blog, Vital Remnants. You can check it out. I put a link to it on the show's blog, mikeallenshow.blogspot.com, Vital Remnants. And he's got a piece up about how an ancient Greek philosopher actually predicted the winner of last week's presidential race. I had Martin on just a couple of weeks ago talking about the election. He was articulating why he was not going to vote for either major party candidate. I think a lot of people assumed he would be a lock for Trump, but he was making clear why he would vote for neither candidate because of issues, concerns, same ones that I had really in many ways. But he's wrote an interesting piece now how if we'd have just paid attention to Aristotle, we would have seen this coming. So look forward to that conversation with Martin. We'll also talk about an article I didn't get to yesterday, Cutting in the Confessional, very interesting from Crux, the website, who is edited by my guest just the last 30 minutes, John Allen. And by the way, if you missed that conversation, you want to definitely check it out on podcasts through Google Play, iTunes, or Podbean. Always enjoy talking with John L. Allen Jr. And appreciate him taking time out of his many demands, including his own radio show now on the Sirius Catholic Channel, to be with us and to give us his thoughts not only about happenings in the U.S. Catholic Church with the election yesterday. Congratulations to Cardinal Daniel DiNardo being elected president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which is a national organization of bishops. Lots of countries have them. Really, they developed after the Second Vatican Council. He's the new president. He was vice president, replacing the outgoing Archbishop Joseph Kurtz, who's been president. And Archbishop Jose Gomez of Los Angeles stepping into the vice presidential role. Always enjoy talking with he is in many ways the journalistic equivalent of the Vatican, right? The Vatican is, as John L. Allen said, he is not the Vatican's first rodeo, how to deal with politicians with points of view that are at odds with Catholic teaching. And we've certainly had that case with every president in recent memory on some issues, for sure. Also, the point of view perspective of the Vatican is not American-centric like it is for us. And so we have to remember that word Catholic means universal. It is a worldwide church. And there are other issues of concern to the Vatican besides the United States. As I said, I think the world's most populous Catholic country, the Philippines, has its issues and problems of its own. And John L. Allen is, in many ways, you know, the Vatican, it's not their first rodeo. They don't set off the alarm bells. They don't wring their hands. They just go about the work, pray, do the work. No time for whining. And I think John L. Allen is the same way. I can't help but wonder if John's sensibilities weren't shaped and crafted a little bit, too, by his experience growing up on a Kansas farm, you know? Not your first rodeo when you've grown up on a farm. You've seen wind, you've seen rain, you've seen drought, you've seen hail, you've seen snow. And there's not really a lot of time for kvetching about it. Somebody's still got to plow, somebody's still got to work. And as always, you pray. So there's some pretty good wisdom, I think, there for all of us. We need to be the church in the midst of the world. That's why I really love these readings that we're in now here during the second to last week of the liturgical year. Of course, this coming Sunday will be the Feast of Christ the King, the end, the last Sunday of the liturgical year. We'll still have next week, that follows from that Sunday, and then we'll enter into Advent, believe it or not. But we're in the book of Revelation. We have come through the liturgical year. We're now at the end of the biblical witness, St. John's vision of heaven, really. And as I said, we mistake Revelation when we see it only as a futuristic book, as a book that paints what we aspire and hope will happen one day, hope in the sense of some sort of distant dream. And even though maybe we have some assurance ultimately that, yes, this is going to be the case, we know who wins the story, we say, and so forth and so on, what we sometimes, I think, fail to understand is that victory is present as a foretaste even now. It's not just simply, you know, you could look at that particular point of view, the hope of certainty. Like, you know, for example, you watch a movie that you've seen before, and maybe it's a fairly intense film. I think about the movie Captain Phillips, if you've seen that, which I think is one of the best films Tom Hanks has done in some time. It tells the story of the big freighter ship that was hijacked by Somali pirates. I think it's a fascinating film, and the men who play the Somali pirates, particularly brilliant. Tom Hanks plays the captain on board the ship who, you know, it all ends up okay for him, even though it's very harrowing. And, of course, based on a true story. You know, you watch that film, even though I've seen it a number of times, I still get a little bit wrought up inside in the midst of it, of what he goes through. And that frightening moment when the pirates first climb on board the ship, machine guns in hand, even though you know how it's going to end. And sometimes we think of the Christian hope like that. We know how it's going to end. It's like watching a tape of a game. You know your team won. You cannot be quite so stressed out. But it's more than that. The book of Revelation is more than that. It's more than just a preview of things to come. It is a revealing of how things truly are, beyond what we can see, much like the Eucharist itself. Our Lord present, hidden, veiled, under what appear to be ordinary bread and wine, veiled to his glory, which is truly and really present with us. Therefore, when we receive the Eucharist, when that host falls on our tongue, we are encountering the Lord who is truly with us. It's like that beautiful encounter, Luke 24, when Jesus accompanies the travelers on the road to Emmaus, and they have this companion who walks with them, lifting their spirits, encouraging them, breaking open the word so that they can understand how the events in Jerusalem were written into salvation history from the beginning. And then when they stop for the night, ask this stranger to tarry with them. He sits down at table. He takes the bread. He breaks the bread, gives it to them, and all of a sudden they see Jesus, who's been with them the entire time. As I said, the book of Revelation has to be understood and seen as a book that brings light to the liturgy and what we experience when we celebrate Mass, when heaven and earth kiss and ultimate realities are made present to us. Today's reading from Revelation 4, when St. John has a vision of an open door to heaven. He's caught up in the Spirit. He sees the throne surrounded by other thrones, 24 thrones representing the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 apostles. The flame torches burning in front of the throne, the sevenfold Spirit of God in front of the throne, the creatures, each evoking different images and symbolism, and day and night they don't stop exclaiming, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." Just as we sing the Sanctus, or say the Sanctus in the Mass, the "Holy, holy, holy Lord God of hosts," we are confessing that reality is not what it seems. Our Lord is the victor even now, and we can have a foretaste. And here's the thing. We as church, we are to be reflective of that victory in the midst of the world. This is, you know, when we talk about pray, hope, and don't worry, we do those things because we are to be, as Christ's body, a living sign in the world of an alternate reality, the true reality. That's one of the things I think that has bothered me about this entire election process. As in many ways, we have fallen victim, I think, as Catholics, to the same sort of partisan stuff as the rest of the world. And I'm not sure they look and see us in our interpartisan bickering and all the rest as an alternate polis, an alternate reality, an alternate community where things are different, where we don't talk in terms of left and right. We talk in terms of love, humility, grace, justice. If we want to be in the world who we're called to be, that's the challenge and that's the call, is to bear witness that in us the veil might be pulled back to the victory, not that will happen one day, but to the victory that is happening even now and present to us, yes, made manifest in the Mass, but when we who receive this victory through his body and blood are sent forth. That word Mass, as Father Alan Carter reminded me a couple of weeks ago, comes from that word missa, mission, that's sending forth with the body and blood of Christ within us, transformed so that hidden even under the veil of our own flesh, Christ the Lord is revealed. He is King of our polis. Yes, we're citizens of this world, but even more citizens of the world to come. Are we showing it through our lives? That's a great question. We'll be back with more. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour. You're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Wednesday, the 16th of November. My pleasure to be with you at the bottom of the hour. We'll be talking with my good friend Martin Cothran, who has an excellent blog. Check it out, Vital Remnants. And he talks about how this U.S. presidential election was predicted by the Greek philosopher Aristotle several millennia ago, if we were just paying attention. So I'll leave you hanging on that. Asking a question of the day. Very deep, profound theological question. Imagine you are the first one to the bucket of fried chicken. And as I said, you're not, you know, choosing some sort of Philippians 2 self-emptying exercise here. You are just a hunter-gatherer. You are your most primal self. You're grabbing that bucket of chicken. Which piece are you going for? You're the first one to the bucket. Which piece are you taking? 573-4-BREAD-4. 573-4-BREAD-4. Some comments we've gotten on this. Let's say Dave just posted a little picture of a leg. So I'm assuming that's what that is. Melissa says leg or thigh, unless it's Kentucky Fried Chicken. I can't eat that, she says, after my high school career there. That's not a good sign when somebody's worked at a restaurant and they won't eat the food. Please, I'd rather live in my naivete and still enjoy my extra crispy, Melissa. Thank you very much. Some other comments we've gotten. Let's see. Daniel says, I love it all, but if I'm first, I'm grabbing the biggest wing. Allison says, the chicken leg. Jessica, the leg. Bob says, I go for the wing first, tasty. I'm just amazed at how few people say they're grabbing the breast. I mean, the breast was always seen as, your father works hard. He deserves the breast. Anyway, Jennifer says, white meat all the way. Give me a juicy chicken breast. Yeah, I mean, you can get a dry breast, and that's no fun. So if you want to chime in, 573-4BREAD-4, call or text, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or post on Facebook or Twitter. I meant to get to this article yesterday. This is also from Crux on John Allen's website, but this written by a priest, Father Terrence Klein. Lessons from the Confessional on Dealing with Cutting. He writes, after 20 years of primarily scholastic ministry, I have returned to parish work, and hearing so many confessions about cutting is new for me. I've come to see that it represents a deep intuitive search for wholeness. Cutting isn't self-loathing. It's an inarticulate cry for help. He talks about, you know, stepping into the confessional more regularly for the first time in years. And he heard this phrase, you know, I cut myself. He said, it's a bold statement, which I repeatedly hear in confessions of high school youth, one offered along with more mundane sins, like disobeying one's parents or stealing a jacket at school. Sometimes it's followed by a specification. Let the young person behind the screen will add, on my stomach. In one face-to-face confession, the young man showed me his arms. He said, in 3 decades of hearing confessions, Father Klein says, in three decades of hearing confessions, I developed the attitude of Koheleth, the author of Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new under the sun. But after 20 years of primarily scholastic ministry, I have returned to parochial ministry. And he said, hearing so many confessions about cutting is new for me. There may be some of you, if your parents listening, you're nodding your head because you've been shocked by this, maybe even in your own family. He said, it's important to know that millennials, like other post-baby boomer generations, have little reticence about confessing sins to a priest. I hear a lot of high school age confessions, but they don't necessarily represent a resurgence in faith, he said. He said, when asked to do so, many contemporary youth will make confession of sins on a youth retreat or as a part of a confirmation prep, but this isn't inevitably a personal expression of piety. It's simply not the onerous, oft-shunted task that it was for their grandparents. They've grown up in a culture, as he says, premised upon self-disclosure, even self-promotion. But he says, I'm hearing of cutting because simply I'm there to listen. He makes this interesting analogy that hearing confessions, he says, is something of an ecclesial triage. Much of it, what comes in, is routine, even trivial, but when it's not, the confessor must make immediate, often consequential decisions. How should one respond to what one has just heard? Which is the greatest danger to the soul in front of you, saying too much or too little? I was talking about this with a priest yesterday who's a new priest. Saying, what's that experience been like, hearing confessions? I said, did you have good preparation in seminary for this? And he said, yeah, there was a whole class on it, of course, and they did mock confessions. He said, but even, and so in that sense, there's preparation, but really no amount of preparation can really prepare you sometimes for the things you hear. And I've heard many priests say they never feel more like a priest than they do in the vulnerability and the humility of the confession. And yes, there are, as we talked about earlier, you know, with bishops, bishops bring their own humanity to the task. Grace builds on nature. The same with priests in the confessional. Therefore, you have priests who are very gifted in terms of their personal qualities as good confessors. You've got some that are not so much. Same grace and absolution available, because thank God the church in her wisdom spoke the revealed truth that the effectiveness of the sacrament is not dependent upon the personal piety of the minister. We can thank St. Augustine for doing some of the heavy lifting there and the rejection of Donatism. Ex opere operato, we call it in the Latin, by the work done. Anyway, back to Father Klein's column. He says, when in doubt, as I was as I was in hearing of so much self-mutilation, it's best to opt for the latter, which is saying too little, but pastoral responsibility sent me in search of resources, which I went to encapsulate and share. He goes on to say that cutting is a new rising phenomenon. It first became a focus of psychiatric interest in the 1960s. In her 1999 book, A Bright Red Scream, journalist Marilee Strong estimated that perhaps one in five adolescents of all races, ethnicities, and economic classes engage in the process. Wow, 20%. As he says, first, what cutting is not. It's not part of group rituals, nor an adolescent trend of narcissistic attention seeking. It may be spread by suggestion, but only to those with an underlying predisposition. It is not failed suicide. It isn't targeted at arteries, veins, or major tendons. Back in 1938, he notes, Carl Menninger suggested that deliberate self-injury wasn't an instance of self-loathing, but a groping towards self-healing, a compromise between aggressive suicidal impulses and the survival instinct. He wrote at the time, in this sense, it represents a victory, even though sometimes a costly one, of the life instinct over the death instinct. Dr. Eileen Russell, Father Klein goes on to say, a clinical psychologist who graciously reviewed this article and has just authored a book for psychotherapists on resilience, underscored this point. She said this, even our conversation or conservation and survival-oriented self-protective strategies, which may include those that appear to be and are self-harming, they are manifestations of resilience. I think of the motto of resilience being all things a person does on behalf of the self. And so along with burning, headbanging, and pulling out body hair, professionals designate cutting as NSSI, non-suicidal self-injury. None of these are about enjoying pain. The young person cutting is under strong emotional duress, typically centered in the family, or maybe the result of emotional, physical, or sexual abuse. I always think of that song, that Johnny Cash cover of the Nine Inch Nails song, Hurt. You know, I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. As Father Klein points out, the vast majority of cutters are females who are also most at risk for sexual abuse, the single largest factor contributing to self-mutilation. He says he's been corrected about using the word cutters because it reduces people to an activity. Cutting is what they do, not who they are. I'm going to post a link to this article on the show's Facebook page because I think it can be very helpful. This is one of those issues we really have to talk about more. We tend to want to pretend these things aren't happening. They're happening around us, or to pretend that somehow it's outside the realm of our faith. We are so, I don't know, I sense lately a lot of dismissiveness toward millennials, a lot of mocking them, which is not uncommon. I mean, older generations have always mocked the young. I'm not saying that they're beyond critique, but I think sometimes maybe we could cut them a little bit of slack and realize, you know, circumstances, context change, but the human person does not. And maybe there's something in this that we should pay attention to and learn from and seek to understand more fully if we're going to bring the good news of God's grace to bear. We'll be back in just a minute. I'm going to talk to my friend Martin Cothran about Aristotle and how he called the U.S. election several millennia ago. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on
Wednesday, November 16th. Had to think for a minute there. My coffee needs to kick in a little bit better. I'm pleased to have with me on the phone Martin Cothran. Martin, who blogs at the excellent blog Vital Remnants. You can check it out. He also has articles, in fact, the one we'll talk about today, on the blog Intellectual Takeout. But you can find a link to it at his show blog. Martin, who is a policy analyst for the Family Foundation of Kentucky, a group that works to promote the common good in the Commonwealth, as well as a classical education author, advocate, and often quoted on issues of public concern. From beautiful Danville, Kentucky, Martin Cothran. Good morning, Martin.
Morning, Mike.
You are in Danville. I know you do a lot of globetrotting, so.
Yeah, I'm in Danville here. I've got my new little sunroom going on in my backyard so I can see all the trees that are losing their leaves right now because we're going into some cold weather. So.
Which means you got to get out and rake them.
No, fortunately, we live on a hill and there's a lot of wind.
So your neighbors get them. That's good.
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
That's right. We'll call that distributism of another sort. How about that?
Yes, I like it.
Well, you were just on the show a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about the U.S. presidential election, and you had made public your stand that you would not vote for either major party candidate. As I said, people make their mistake when they pigeonhole Martin Cothran, for sure. But now here we are 2 weeks later, and it turns out he didn't need our votes, did he?
No, he didn't, and he didn't need some people's votes in Los Angeles and New York and
yep.
other places. That's a whole other issue, the Electoral College. But
now, are you as nerdy as me on election night? I mean, do you pop popcorn and sit there and watch it all unfold? That's kind of what I do.
On election night, I can out nerd you so bad.
My feeling was, Martin. Now, and again, I believe me, I'm no Martin Cothran, but I'm watching the thing unfold, and I'm seeing how close it was to Virginia, which had been portrayed as a Clinton lock. That's when I first started getting this feeling that maybe he was going to outperform his poll numbers and that we might have a surprise on our hands.
Yeah, I was just watching the falling countenances of Jake Tapper and Wolf Blitzer. Even though I did not vote for him, I think may have said this in your show, I don't remember. I did prefer that he win than Hillary for a number of reasons, but I there were things about him that, you know, I mean, when the Clinton thing was going on, you know, we said character counted.
Right.
And clearly there was a problem here. But I'm glad he won than Hillary. But there were a lot of other people, places like CNN, that clearly did not want him to win or expect him to win. You know, apparently I heard yesterday the champagne corks were being popped the evening before by the Clinton campaign, and that was rather ironic now.
So. Definitely. And, you know, it calls into question the whole science of polling, that's for sure. But let's talk about, you know, as you said in your piece here that's linked on your show's blog, but written primarily for the website Intellectual Takeout, that if we'd have just paid attention to our Aristotle, then maybe we would have seen this coming.
Yeah, we tend to rely on pollsters for predicting elections, but in this case, we might have been better off listening to a philosopher. Aristotle wrote a book called Rhetoric. It's really the first, and some people think still the best book on persuasive communication ever written. And in there, I can kind of summarize. I've taught this for many years, and I have a book called Classical Rhetoric that basically leads you through that book. But his analysis is very simple. He says there are three kinds of persuasive appeal. There are three what he calls modes of persuasion, three ways that you are persuaded. You're persuaded by a speaker's character. You know, sometimes you'll believe somebody just because of who they are. It's their credibility, maybe their expertise, maybe their humility, maybe their honesty. It's the character of the speaker. That's called ethos. Logos, the second appeal, is the rational force of their arguments. Does what they say sound valid? And that has to do with what they're saying. And the third thing is pathos, ethos, logos, and pathos. Pathos is the ability of a speaker to make you want to believe them. There's just something inspiring about what they say. And when this election was over, I noticed one of the criticisms by Democrats themselves of Hillary Clinton was that she was not inspiring. Now, I actually wrote about this several times before the election. This is my analysis just after the election. I wrote this before the election, and I said, you know, the pathos candidate usually wins. We can talk a little bit about this. The pathos candidate usually wins, and I had backed away from my analysis because, like most people, I didn't think Trump was going to win. I said, now, normally this is what would happen, but there are other factors here, so, well, we'll have to see. My analysis played out.
I mean, do you
think... Nobody's calling me and getting me in these news shows saying, you predict the election.
Don't hold your breath, Martin. You never know, but you know, don't hold your breath. Yeah. So if you picture these three, then, you know, pathos, logos, and ethos as a three-legged stool, I mean, obviously you feel like in the American electorate process, pathos gives a little imbalance to the stool. I mean, you know, it carries more weight. Do you think that's true just of American culture, or do you think that's been true of human history in general?
Well, you know, Aristotle's work was written almost 2,500 years ago, and I think... But with the Greeks, they didn't know God, but they had man pegged. They had figured out human nature, and so I think if you take this analysis through, you'll see that it's always been the case. It was the case when Mark Antony gave his funeral oration over the dead body of Caesar, because Brutus gets up there in the Shakespeare account. Brutus gets up there, and he's all logos. I'm an honorable man, he says over and over again. Well, Mark Antony gets up there and mocks him on this. He says that Brutus is a noble man in a mocking way, and he appeals to, he says, a mostly pathos-driven appeal. And it's Mark Antony's speech that makes the difference. And in elections, you know, we've seen this over and over again. You know, we had Bill Clinton, just let's take a couple examples if we've got a minute here. Bill Clinton versus Bob Dole. I think that was, what, 94?
Bob Dole.
And
Bob Dole. Bob That's Dole. What I was thinking.
Bob Dole. Yeah, right. Bob Dole, who always referred to himself in the third person. No one knows why. I think interestingly, one of the reasons he always did refer to himself in the third person, he'd say, Bob Dole believes, you know, is because it was an ethos feel. He was a war hero. You know, his right arm was actually, he couldn't use it because of his service in Korea. He was considered capable, honest. There was nothing wrong about his character. It was an ethos-driven appeal, whereas Bill Clinton was, you know, Bill Clinton felt your pain. He was an inspiring candidate for a lot of people. His appeal was pathos-driven. There was an article by Tom Oliphant, or a cartoon by Tom Oliphant at the time, and it showed this restaurant scene where Bob Dole was up at a microphone in the restaurant talking about Bob Dole, and Clinton was sitting at a table with a woman who was the voter, and he had her hand, and he was talking to her very sympathetically, and there were two musicians, you know, playing the violin, and it just perfectly captured that campaign. Then fast forward to the Obama-Romney election. Romney, who was almost a solely logos-driven candidate, his arguments were all abstract economic argumentation. He had facts and figures. Whereas Obama...
He was a little like almost like a Max Headroom. I mean, he was almost, you know, he was just... Yeah, just kind of cool, yeah. Detached in a sense.
And then you had Obama, who's this inspiring candidate, who's going to be the first black president, and all these very inspiring things, a pathos-driven appeal. Pathos won again. And you see this over and over again, because it goes back to something St. Augustine said. He said that we always do what we desire to do. You know, we like to think that it's our intellect by which we make our judgments in this world. But actually, it's the heart. And if a candidate knows how to appeal to that, then he's more likely to win. And it happened again this year. Trump was a almost completely gut-level candidate. There was something visceral in his appeal to many voters. And a lot of it was anger. It was an emotion that he was tapping into. And he drove it all the way to the White House.
He did. And, you know, that's interesting. So this pathos, and you kind of looked at some other historical, you know, you had Nixon's logos versus Kennedy's pathos.
Kennedy's pathos.
Gerald Ford's ethos versus Jimmy Carter's pathos. And other factors.
Yes.
We're about at the end of this segment. Can you hold on for a couple minutes on the other side of the break? Okay,
sure.
Fantastic. We'll be back in just a minute with Martin Cothran, who, if you want to check out his work, I put a link to this article on the show's blog page, mikeallenshow.blogspot.com, also on the show's Facebook page. You can go to his blog, Vital Remnants, which is really good, how Aristotle predicted the U.S. election. History, always a good teacher. We'll be back in just a minute with more. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Wednesday, the 16th of November, here with my good friend Martin Cothran. Martin, who holds forth at his blog, Vital Remnants. Check it out. Definitely just Google it up. You'll come across it. I also posted a link to the article we're talking about from the blog Intellectual Takeout on the show's Facebook page. Martin is also a classical education author and advocate with Memoria Press. He also is a policy analyst for the Family Foundation. Thanks for holding on, Martin.
Thanks, Mike.
So we're talking about
I've got one more thing here on our analysis that we didn't talk about.
Okay.
Which I think your listeners would be interested in. You know, I said that we talked about ethos, logos, and pathos. The pathos candidate almost always wins. And that Trump was an example of that. Hillary being, by the way, a logos-driven candidate, because if you listen to her speeches, this was one of the critiques of her, even by liberal media people, was that she was boring because her speeches were lists of policy prescriptions. But
see, I mean, there was no question that
ethos, logos,
you could see in the
analysis.
I was going to say you could see it. You could. I mean, I think even a fair observer in the debates, you got a sense that Hillary had more of an intellectual grasp, let's just say, about things, not that she necessarily agreed with her, than did Donald Trump, who talked more in generalizations.
Yes. That's correct. That's correct. But if you take this ethos, logos, pathos analysis, it's interesting to apply that to Ronald Reagan, who is known as the great communicator. Because one of the things you realize about Reagan was that he was operating on all three things. This is why I think nobody's ever been able to explain why he's the great communicator. I think it's because he had mastered all three modes of persuasion. He had a radio show in Los Angeles, and I grew up in Los Angeles, a daily radio program where he argued the conservative position every day on KABC radio, and it was always a very intelligent approach in addition to other things, but it was always a very reasoned, convincing approach. It appealed to your intellect. He had the logos thing down. Ethos, you know, Ronald Reagan seemed like the nicest guy. Even Sam Donaldson, who was one of the reporters who kind of coined the whole expression, the whole idea of the media being a sort of oppositional type of institution, you know, against government, looking for the flaws. Even he loved Reagan. So he had ethos and pathos. You know, he was the guy who originally, who's the first president to have his State of the Union address and recognize a person, a hero, from the gallery. A very pathos kind of thing to do. He was clicking on all cylinders there. That's why I think he was a great communicator.
Hmm. And why, I guess, in 84, he won 49 states.
Yeah. Right.
So are there, because it's interesting on the whole ethos thing, right? Because certainly this was an ethos-challenged race. You had Hillary, but I wonder, in terms of if you look at the you know, electoral history of the United States, are there some deficiencies of ethos that the voting public are more willing to overlook than others? So, like, for example, in this race, it seemed like you had more of a public ethos problem with Hillary Clinton, with the, you know, with the emails and the sort of abuse of office type of accusations, whereas with Donald Trump, it was more personal ethos, much like with Bill Clinton, you know. Not that there weren't some public aspects of and concerns there, mm-hmm. but primarily, do you think the public more willing to tolerate sort of personal ethos deficiencies than public?
Yes. I mean, I think that's why some people use the word peccadillo. Okay, they'll call a private sin, if you will, that doesn't affect their job a peccadillo. And I think that's why, even though the word comes from peccare, which means sin in Latin, I think in the Clinton case, what you had was what a lot of people considered a peccadillo that just got revealed in public, the Monica Lewinsky scandal. It was something they felt that didn't affect his job. It wasn't like, you know, corruption in the Clinton Foundation and all this other stuff that concerns conflict of interest, which does affect her role as president. Yeah, I think people are more forgiving about those kinds of things. Yeah.
Do you think, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, and we've certainly seen the reaction, particularly among the so-called millennial generation. You know, it's often been said we live in a therapeutic age where, you know, where this pathos has always held a certain sway, perhaps in this age and maybe the coming few decades, pathos is going to be even more significant. So when you think about the future of elections and so forth, when you look out among the young, and I tend to be a little bit more reticent to just blanketly mock the younger generation, as I sometimes see a lot of people do, particularly on social media. You know, they're entitled, sheltered, you know, whatever. I mean, there's certainly some truth in that. But do you think that it's going to even hold greater sway in coming decades as these youthful generations come of age?
And that's a really good question. Yes, I do, because, you know, people are less and less, I should say probably more and more, at the service of their emotions. They're less and less well-educated. And when you're less educated, you're more at the mercy of your emotions. And, you know, we've got a whole culture that's been raised on Oprah and The View and all these kinds of shows, and that's all they do is appeal to your emotions. We're not training the minds of students anymore. And so I think as we go on here, and I think this is that, you know, the vulnerability of people to emotional appeals is one of the things that is going to fulfill another Greek analysis, which is of the genealogy of governments, you know, where, you know, the Greeks believed that aristocracies fell into oligarchies and then into democracies, and democracies fell into anarchy. And anarchy fell into tyranny, and then it started all over again. Mm. And we just go through that cycle all the time. I think this, what you're pointing out here, is one of the things that's going to cause us to see our what really is a republic, but what people want is a democracy, and that's going to fall into an anarchy because people are just at the service of their emotions.
and therefore susceptible to demagoguery yeah. like no other, you know, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Martin, always a pleasure. Keep up your great work, and we'll continue to talk, hopefully.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
Blessings to you and to Joyce and your family.
You too.
All right. We're going to get on to our Dial a Catechism segment, where we go to this great repository of the Catholic faith, the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Dial up a number between 1 and 2865. We're going to go a little heavy logos on you right here. Random.org, our random number generator. We'll see what Providence has in store for us. Of course, we always know the truth is never random, but always integrated within the panoramic totality of the faith. 1952. I wasn't born yet. Oh, we're talking paragraph, not year. 1952. I guess we just elected Ike back then for his first term. Anyway, I digress. This is under the moral law. There are three different expressions of the moral law, all of them interrelated. Eternal law, the source in God of all law. Natural law and revealed law, which is revealed law, comprising the old and the new law, or law of the gospel. Finally, I'm sorry, I guess these are four, not three. There are different expressions of the moral law. You got eternal law, you got natural law, you've got revealed law, comprising the old law and the new law, or the law of the gospel. Then finally, civil and ecclesiastical laws. Yeah, I think that's an important distinction to make, because sometimes we get the idea that we take civil or maybe even ecclesiastical laws and we want to elevate it. And we have to keep in mind that laws have different gravitas, I guess you could say, based on where they are in the hierarchy of laws. God, who is the source of all law, of course, and natural law, which, you know, that's part of the problem, I think, a distinction we've lost in our culture in terms of thinking, is understanding that, you know, we can change all kind of civil laws, but when civil law purports to change or to redefine what is revealed in nature, then that's when we've kind of jumped the shark, so to speak. I think that was the problem that many have had with, for example, changing laws and in terms of marriage, that marriage is entirely some sort of civil institution that exists and is defined by a cultural context as what is most expedient to the culture, when I think the Catholic point of view would be that the nature of marriage, and when we say natural law, it's not necessarily something that we see happen in nature. It's what is something's true end. What is to use a big philosophical word, what is something's true teleology? And there are certain natural laws, like the law of gravity. You don't break the law of gravity. The law of gravity, as they say, breaks you. So that's an interesting paragraph. Check it out in the whole context of the moral law. 1952. A lot of people have done the heavy lifting. It's a beautiful thing about being Catholic. People have done the heavy lifting before us. We just got to be open-hearted to the so-called democracy of the dead. We'll be back tomorrow by God's grace. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.